This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6-7BG.
And now from the Radio 4 programme International Assignment, John Parry is talking about the British Satellite Broadcasting Television Service.
The cost of it all will be around £250 for the dish on your roof and £10 a month for your subscription. Of course, you may already have paid out rather similar amounts earlier in the year for other equipment to receive Rupert Murdoch's Sky Television. Watching satellite TV could become an expensive hobby, at least for some people. Anthony Simmons-Gooding again.
It's interesting. I go and talk to a lot of retailers, and £250 is not a lot of money, believe it or not, to a lot of people, so long as you're getting something for it. If you then come to the £9.99 a month, for which you're going to get something like four movies a night, you're going to get 24 movies a month, which are first-run movies, never been seen on television before, way ahead of when they would be available on BBC and ITV. Is not an awful lot of money when you think that you're really comparing it with the video rental business. And I suppose it depends on how many you watch. 12 movies a month divided into £9.99. You're under a pound and no inconvenience. So you can see that even on a value for money basis, it's not too bad.
The concept of subscription television is something which may be facing the BBC in the long term, for the Home Secretary has already made it clear, to use his words, that the BBC licence system is not immortal. Paul Fox.
I think that the Home Secretary's words are obviously being weighed carefully, and clearly they were well chosen, and one has to heed them. Subscription television is some way off. The BBC charter is due for renewal in 1996. Now, that is 8 years away. But there's no doubt the subscription issue will not go away. It cannot happen overnight. And what's more, I don't believe it's politically possible to bring about subscription overnight, because a subscription service for the BBC would certainly be more expensive for the audience than the license fees at present.
What about advertising?
I think advertising on the BBC is out, certainly until 1996. Anybody who looks at broadcasting for longer than 5 minutes in the United Kingdom comes up with the same answer. Public service broadcasting is what the BBC is about, and public service broadcasting is what it should remain.
As Paul Fox has already said, television is basically about funding, and in ITV that usually means advertising income. While LWT's Christopher Bland was certain that more and more television channels did not mean more and more advertising would become available, he was equally confident that advertising was still very much an expanding market.
The new channels have got to take viewers from the BBC rather than from ITV to have any impact on the economics of advertising. Advertising has been expanding, television advertising, significantly faster than the rate of inflation, and is forecast to do so for at least the next 10 years. So I believe there's a very considerable buoyancy that can't be met by available audiences and by available minutage. So to some extent, there is a pent-up demand, and that's one of the reasons why advertising costs have increased higher than the rate of inflation for the last 4 or 5 years.
But whatever the problems of financing television, of making programmes or creating policies and profits too, there's another dimension that Paul Fox found disturbing.
Surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, there is a dislike of the broadcasters among certain members of this government. I find it surprising because this government has also made it clear in its election manifesto that they wish to uphold the standards of broadcasting to which this country has become accustomed. And I think that's all one seeks, really. What everybody in this country would like to see, that the standards of broadcasting to which we've become accustomed over the years are upheld and continued. If that happens, everything will be well and good. If, on the other hand, those standards are blown out of the window and people come in and bring in the standards that are associated with one or two newspapers that exist in this country, then I think it's a matter of concern, not so much for the BBC, I think it's a matter of concern for everybody in this country.
For the moment, there are 7 new channels definitely planned for next year, but by the end of 1990, there could be as many as another dozen. But the two who've jumped in first, Rupert Murdoch and Anthony Simmons-Gooding, are spending much of their time attacking each other with rhetoric, while realising they both have to come up with clear alternatives to the BBC ITV output, and somehow to be different from each other as well.
John Parry there, reporting on the Radio 4 programme International Assignment.
Sings. The 6 o'clock alarm would never ring, but it rings and I rise, wipe the sleep out of my eyes. My shaven razor's cold and it stings. Cheer up, sleepy Jean. Oh, what can it
Audio Restoration from Lineup magazine, the Institute of Broadcast Sound publication. At an IBS meeting in late March, Peter Copeland of the National Sound Archive discussed the history and development of the NSA's Computer Enhanced Digital Audio Restoration System, known as CDAR, claimed as a revolution in signal processing technology. In 1983, the National Sound Archive was formed when the British Institute of Recorded Sound was amalgamated with the British Library. Soon after, the NSA's new director approached Rupert Neave and Company to see whether it would be possible to build a machine to restore deteriorated sound recordings. The resulting unit was, in fact, only the third digital console they made. It was a 4-in, 2-out computer system, incorporating all the equalisation, dynamics and filtering facilities of a conventional analogue desk channel and, of course, operating in the digital domain. Neave confidently expected that digital processing would extend what was possible in analogue, In particular, it was hoped that the clicks and pops from damaged disc records could be drastically reduced, and the console was delivered with an extra button labelled Scratch Reduction. Unfortunately, funds ran out for the necessary research, but instead Neave suggested the work should be carried out at the University of Cambridge Department of Engineering. This got underway in a typically British low-key manner, using a BBC Model B computer to write some experimental programs. Before long, an agreement was reached whereby the National Sound Archive provided the university with two IBM AT desktop microcomputers, the top-of-the-range model of our time. They also offered to sponsor a postgraduate student to work on the project for his PhD. The student was Saeed Vasiji, working under the director of the communications laboratory, Dr. Peter Rayner. One of the computers was provided with an industrial A to D and D to A card. This converted incoming signals into a string of 12-bit binary integers sampled linearly at 20 kHz. The theory being that if the algorithms gave acceptable results with this relatively limited system, they would certainly sound okay on a system with better audio quality. Another reason was that the sampling rate had to be limited because conventional hard disks of the time couldn't write data fast enough. A 30 megabyte hard card, actually mounted in the computer, was the best then available, but it always anticipated that users would want 16-bit quality, so two full bytes, 16 bits, were allowed for each sample, and the programs were written to cope with any sampling rate which might be recorded on the disk. Software adjustable up to a maximum of 120 kHz. The actual program modules were written in Fortran 77 and compiled on the second computer, and were transferred to the hard disk of the first computer so their performances could be compared using the same audio. Fortran 77 is a language which is particularly efficient at binary arithmetic and handling arrays of data. The project was named CDAR, standing for Computer Enhanced Digital Audio Restoration. A large collection of program modules was quickly built up, many of them interacting so that complex sequences of calculations could be handled. The basic facilities included gain changing, random noise generation, generation of waveforms of various types, visual displays of sections of waveform, time delaying, spectral analysis, and utilities to aid the recording and playback of data and labelling of files. From such material, much more complex programs could be built. Work is still proceeding on these, so I shall confine myself to describing a few which are now in everyday use at the National Sound Archive. Removing crackle. The basic hailstorm noise of shellac pressings has always been one of the most intractable problems of analog signal processing. A novel algorithm was developed which distinguishes the characteristics of music from those of crackle. It can be iterated if necessary, resulting in the complete separation of the crackle from the music and its subtraction in the digital domain. De-clicking. The previous method can't deal with big clicks exceeding the level of the music. It has always been easy enough to detect such clicks, but very difficult to know what to do with them. As you probably know, simply cutting them out, like razor blade splicing quarter-inch tape, gives glitches caused by the generation of sidebands at the edits. Clipping the waveform above the music level reduces the power of the clicks, but doesn't make them inaudible by any means. The solution adopted was to cut a hole in the sound and then to perform a spectral analysis of the waveform either side using an algorithm called a fast Fourier transform. The gap can then be plugged with sound of the same spectral content. As you can see, it takes several quite different algorithms to patch a de-clicked recording, but the whole process can be initiated by a single menu-driven command. Unfortunately, when that method was designed, it wasn't the complete answer. Playing a cracked record shock excites a pickup arm into resonances of its own, audible as a thump after the click has been removed. Another series of algorithms had to be invoked to cure this. First, it is necessary to build a template of the thump. A couple of dozen thumps have to be located manually. This can't be automated because the computer doesn't know the difference between a pickup arm thump and, say, a bass drum note. The computer then averages the waveforms and builds up a template of the thump in the absence of music. Having located the click, the template can be mod-matched and added in antiphase at the same time. Equalization and filtering. All the usual curve shaping can be done, including some quite sophisticated brick wall filtering, all in the digital domain. Computer graphics can show the resulting frequency and phase responses. On the present version, the parameters have to be entered via the keyboard, but it is planned that a mouse will be used to draw the desired response on the screen. This is a very good way of dealing with strange recording characteristics, one example of which was the old BBC 78 RPM curve, which was an almost straight line of 2 dBs per octave for pre-emphasis. Continuing with Peter Copeland's description of the National Sound Archive system for improving the quality of old shellac and disc recordings. Adaptive noise cancelling. This option is used when two different copies of a record exist. Basically, the computer synchronises the two records and chooses the quieter at any one instant. This has proved to be a very powerful system, reducing the noise of two average 78 records by about 12 or 15 decibels. The advantage for the archivist is that the original sound is maintained in every detail, and there is no synthesis or filtering. One option we do not use for the archive is spectral weighting. This is a sophisticated way of eliminating any remaining background noise, such as master tape hiss. But it can sometimes affect the wanted sound. It is aimed at the commercial market, where any background noise is usually considered intolerable. A fast Fourier transform analysis is made of a typical sample of the background noise. The recording is divided into blocks of typically 50 milliseconds, and a fast Fourier transform analysis of each of these blocks is also performed. Then, one is subtracted from the other, and the result is like an enormous number of noise gates, each acting on a different part of the frequency range. The fast Fourier transform algorithm requires the frequency range to be split into a number of bands, which is a power of 2. We usually choose 1024, giving about 100 noise gates per octave. The basic research on the algorithms I've mentioned so far was completed in mid-1987. User-friendly command menus were then added, and we got our hands on the prototype AT computer on the very day of the Institute of Broadcast Sound meeting last March. But, as we're using a desktop microcomputer, as opposed to a much more powerful computer like the Neve DSP, it usually takes several hundred times as long to process a recording as it does to play it. This doesn't matter very much for National Sound Archive internal work. We can load a 78 RPM disk into it before we go home, and the computer will work on it all night and have it ready for us next morning. However, the very fact that you can't walk up to the machine and twiddle it to suit your subjective taste means that you have to think about what you are doing objectively, which is a good thing from the archival point of view. However, work is proceeding on a number of fronts to increase the speed. Desktop computers and their hard disks have got very much faster since the Model AT. And there are also many ways of harnessing the proven algorithms to other hardware. There are also plans afoot to make CEDAR more generally available. The first aim is to set up a bureau service late in 1988, probably sited in London. A small group of trial customers should receive the equipment itself in the autumn, and general marketing through a company now being set up is targeted for late 1988. In the meantime, CEDAR's first big task will be to work through a large number of wax cylinders of ethnic music recorded on location at the beginning of the century and beginning to show signs of crumbling away. We predict that CEDAR and its successors will be kept busy in the archive indefinitely.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
Now Eddie Caffrey with a million-selling single.
Shocking Blue, Venus, released in 1969 on the Pink Elephant label in Holland, on the Colossus label in the United States, and on the Penny Farthing record label in the UK. Its original UK catalogue number, Penny Farthing, PEN702, backed with Hot Sand on the B-side. The success of Shocking Blue, a quartet from The Hague, Holland, brought new optimism and enthusiasm to the Dutch scene. Their leader, Robert van Leeuwen, born in 1944, played lead guitar and well known in Holland, where he originally led a band called The Motions for 3 years. He then went into record production for a year and soon after decided he wanted another group. Shocking Blue were the result. And he produced Venus as well as writing the song. Venus became a big hit in Holland, where it reached number 3 in the summer of 1969. Thereafter, it became number 1 in Belgium, France, Sweden, Australia and Switzerland, number 2 in Germany, where it sold 350,000 copies, and also entered the charts in Italy, Scandinavia, Australia and Canada. Its big continental success resulted in the United States release on the Colossus label in November 1969. It shot up the American charts and reached number 1 and stayed there for 3 weeks in January 1970 and spent a total of 14 weeks on the American Hot 100, making Holland's first American chart topper. It sold a million copies by the end of January 1970 and was awarded a gold disc. Global sales were estimated over 5 million by March of 1970. In Britain, it was released on the Penny Farthing label in January 1970, and it reached number 8 on the 28th of February of that year. Shocking Blues style is a mixture of rock and country with a simple rock beat and driving guitar riff. Their sudden success was attributed to the simplicity of their music at a time when supergroups' music was getting more and more complicated. The worldwide success of Venus not only put Shocking Blue on the map, but also Robert Van Leeuwen as producer and songwriter. He had written consistent hits in Holland and had an international hit song with My Love Is Growing, recorded by the Walker Brothers. The Shocking Blue, by 1973, sold 13.5 million discs. Here's one of them, Venus.
Innovative, information-based radio, broadcasting to the people who really listen to shortwave. This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. Some reactions to the government's white paper on broadcasting published recently. This one from Peter Jenkins of The Independent, entitled The Day They Threw Quality to the Dogs. It is possible that the measures proposed by the government for the reorganisation of commercial television will do more over time to shape the future of our society permanently than all the rest of what we call Thatcherism put together. We have it on the authority of the Prime Minister herself that television is the most powerful medium ever known to man or woman. Its power is to shape people's understanding of the world, a power it exercises from early childhood. In the electronic mass society, image is a food to the body politic, nutritious or poisonous. This isn't a matter of political balance, least of all that. It's a question of what visions of reality or of human fulfilment are projected before the eyes and minds of the people. The Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, affects to believe that this kind of talk is grossly exaggerated. Building upon our rich heritage is his version of what he's doing as he takes account of unstoppable technological developments in the field of broadcasting. If he has convinced himself of that, it is perhaps because he has troubles enough as Mrs. Thatcher's Home Secretary without defying this latest bee in her bonnet. Unfortunately, his power to shape the future of British broadcasting is greater than his powers to curb crime or extend justice. His laid-back view of the matter is not shared by the broadcasters, most of whom regard what is being proposed as having the most profound implications. I am of their opinion, but even if the truth lies somewhere in the middle, the first question is to ask why. Why is one of Britain's most shining claims to excellence to be put at risk? For what good reason? Go anywhere in the world and British television is an object of envy and admiration. Is this to be put at jeopardy because of the Prime Minister's personal pique with the broadcasting authorities and her aversion to bureaucracy in all circumstances? Her desire to breach one of the last bastions of unconscionable trade union restrictionism is a more worthy motivation, but hardly sufficient reason for throwing quality to the walls of commercialism. Certainly the advance of technology threatened the sanctity of Britain's television oasis, but that did not require the whole plantation to be uprooted and bulldozed over in such a fashion. His proposals were of necessity radical, said Mr. Hurd, to enable broadcasters to make the most of the opportunities offered by the new technology. When Goebbels heard the word culture, he reached for his gun. When we hear the word technology in this context, we might as well reach for the sun. Viewers who have not glimpsed Rupert Murdoch's Luxembourg-based Sky Channel ain't viewed nothing yet. But the government has yet to show that the advent of the satellite makes the measures that it is proposing either necessary or desirable. The only good argument is that more will mean better, not worse. Mr. Hurd has claimed so, but it was difficult to see on what grounds or why the extension of choice should require such wholesale deregulation. The foundation of Britain's excellence in the field of television is the tradition of public service broadcasting as upheld by the BBC. When ITV came along, the BBC was obliged to condescend somewhat to the marketplace, and the commercial companies, for their part, to lift their eyes somewhat to the statue of Lord Reith. It has turned out, on the whole, a healthy interaction. The only good defence of Mr. Hurd's proposals would be that it could be shown that they would strengthen that public service tradition and ensure its survival within the new competitive environment. But it is scarcely believable that this is the government's intention and highly improbable that it will be the outcome. Optimists at Broadcasting House believe that the White Paper would leave the BBC by 1996 when its charter comes up, a protected and securely financed enclave in the new world of competitive broadcasting. But that is not what this government intends. The White Paper requires that the BBC must learn, at first, to supplement a diminishing licence fee income and eventually to replace it altogether by subscription income, that is to say, by charging viewers to watch certain programmes. In other words, it must also compete in the marketplace for paying customers. Channel 4's remit as a minority and high-quality commercial channel is to be preserved ostensibly, but it is to market its own advertising wares in future. What if Channel 4's income in the new and fiercely competitive environment doesn't match its responsibilities? The government has not yet found an answer, although one of the options canvassed in the White Paper includes a guaranteed minimum income. All in all, the future of British broadcasting, with its core tradition of public service, looks thoroughly unsafe in this government's hands. Well, that was a view expressed by Peter Jenkins in the Independent newspaper in an article entitled The Day They Threw Quality to the Dogs. and it promoted some letters in response, one of which was from Nicholas Kish, the director of the European Communication Management, and he wrote, "Dear Sir, are we really such a nation of reactionary wimps as Peter Jenkins portrays us? The day they threw quality to the dogs. His championship of the status quo ante in UK broadcasting, which would have us and the rest of the world feel uniquely privileged and satisfied with the BBC as the only source of television programmes. Broadcasters, programme makers and audiences are made of much more diverse and enterprising stuff. It is no surprise that people who only ever watch BBC and those broadcasters who have benefited from the restriction of access to our national airwave resources see only the problems and none of the opportunities presented by the white paper. Don't panic. The existing channels have huge advantages over the newcomers. The UK experience, programme libraries and partly amortised infrastructure, to name but three. The old complacency has already given way to a new commercial realism that will generate funds for quality programming. A newly invigorated BBC Enterprises contributed £20 million to programming budgets last year. New agreements with unions are already putting a greater share of ITV revenues on the screen. Satellite channels will not survive if they dish up a diet of pap. If quiz shows and striptease are the recipes for success, why are the UK-targeted Sky and BSB packages promising sports, news and film channels? There will be some tabloid television, but if the Independent and the Sunday Sport can both find a market in readers and advertisers without bankrupting the longer established newspapers, I reckon that British broadcasting can handle the challenge that faces it." And that, again, was from Nicholas Kirsch, who is the Director of the European Communication Management.
And I think we forgot to say at the beginning of that with Maggie Stevenson and Trevor Brook. From Electronic Times, IBA team wins medal for Mac. Pioneering work on a Mac multiplexed analog component colour television technology has landed Dr. Michael Windram and his team of engineers at the Independent Broadcasting Authority with the J.J. Thompson Medal. The award, presented each year by the Institute of Electronic Engineering for outstanding work on electronics theory, manufacture or development, is the climax of 6 years' work by the IBA team. Mac technology, which overcomes many of the shortcomings of television standards, is the European standard for direct broadcasting by satellite.
Raw meat. Our God, from out of land, will win a prize. Won't that be nice? And by the way, how's your wife? Your holidays were spent in Spain. You went by train, you'll go again.
Have you seen me bullfight poster on the wall? Do you know the happy memory it recalls? It's a photograph of me and my son Ted. That's me cousin with his hanky on his head. We booked in at our hotel just after two and met a family from Bradford that we knew.
Finding half of the brain pie separates next door from me. Finding half of the brain pie, oh mama, belongs to me.
Saxophone solo as promised.
Sister in Toronto is a nurse, and I've had a bit of bother laying turf. It's life, not books, that taught me all I've learned. Whoop, in the oven, my rice pudding's getting burnt. Here, have you seen the new attachment on me drill? I must have the cat put down, cos he's ill.
Hey, neighbour!
My
piping harp on the brain pipe.
Here comes the spoon.
Piping half of the brain pipe separates me from the incredibly fascinating story of your life and everyday to day event in all its minute and tedious attention to detail. And was it a Thursday or a Wednesday or... Oh no, it wasn't, so who cares anyway, because I do not so normal. If you're normal, I intend to be a freak for the rest of my life. And I shall baffle you with cabbages and rhinoceroses in the kitchen in sets and quotations from Now We Are Six through the mouthpiece of Lord Snoopy's giant poisoned electric head. So
regarding television, three large holders to sell TVAM stakes. As much as one-third of TVAM is set to change hands, as it emerged that there are three separate sellers of stock. The extent of the continuing musical chairs in TVAM's share register became clear as Australian Alan Bond, a potential bidder for and Tiny Rowland's Longo, confirmed that he was in discussions with various people interested in buying his 14.9% share in the Breakfast Time television station. Mr. Bond appears to have failed to meet his objective of selling the stake before he flew to the United States, although talks are thought to be at a critical stage. In addition, Beaverbrook Investments, the Saudi-controlled investor in TVAM, which was ordered by the IBA to reduce its 25% TVAM stake, still holds a disenfranchised 9.9%. Market sources suggest that following the publication of the government's white paper on broadcasting, the Saudi Arabians are no longer interested in extending their stay in TVAM's share register. Leisure Investments, which recently agreed a merger with Peter de Savary's Land Leisure, said it would sell the latter's 10% stake in TVAM. Shares in TVAM have closed at 159 pence, 3 pence up. Potential buyers of TVAM stock include Mike Luckwell, formerly managing director of Carlton Communications, who earlier this year picked up a 5% stake. Brent Walker has also been touted in the market as a potential buyer. A management buyout of ITC, a film and television production company, was completed recently, raising around £65 million for Mr. Bond's corporation. ITC formed a central part of Lord Grade's ACC empire before Robert Holmes-Harcourt, the Australian businessman, acquired the company in 1982. Despite rumoured interest in ITC from Lord Grade and a Californian group, the management successfully overcame financing difficulties.
Now, news from the Republic of Ireland. We have recently covered the Broadcasting and Wireless Telegraphy Act 1988 and the Broadcasting Act 1988, published in Dublin, which will, for the first time, introduce regulation of the operation of radio and television stations. Justice Henchy, the chairman of the newly formed regulatory body, the Radio and Television Commission, has now announced that it will be about 1 year before any properly authorised stations can be processed. Operators of existing stations have now got together in an organisation to press for a postponement of the enforcement date, presently the 31st of December, of the wireless telegraphy laws, so that there would not be a gap between the old and the new stations. Meetings of station operators have so far been organised in Mullingar, Longford, Monaghan and at Barry's Hotel in Dublin. Involved with the group are the owners of one of the longest standing stations, which is also the most audible in Western Britain, that's Sunshine Radio, 531 kHz, along with representatives from most of the 100 or so stations operating in the Republic. An advertisement has also been prepared to be aired by the stations. It tells listeners what the position is and what the stations are trying to do about it. Interesting developments there. And if the campaign achieves its target, there are two possible mechanisms open to the Dublin government. Firstly, Ray Burke, the Minister for Communications, could propose the enforcement date for the Wireless Telegraphy Act be postponed. The second possible course would be for the Radio and Television Commission to issue an interim permit to every station that applied for one. The Commission could then process the authorisation procedure at leisure.
More on the reactions to the recent white paper on broadcasting. This one from Mary Fagan, the technology correspondent of the Independent newspaper. Questions for Brave New Broadcasting World. The publication of the government's white paper on the future of broadcasting in the United Kingdom has implications that go beyond the debates over regulation, increased competition, and quality of programming. Consumers need to ask how they can get access to the new worlds of television that are opening up, and how they will pay for them where necessary. Industry, on the other hand, is faced with providing the right technology on time and at a cost that will attract both the broadcast industry and the public it seeks to serve. The fifth terrestrial channel, covering up to 70% of the nation, might provide more choice, but it could also cause a few technological headaches. Industry observers agree that viewers will almost certainly need another aerial to receive it, partly because of its position in the frequency spectrum and where the signal is broadcast from. The outgoing Independent Broadcasting Authority had recommended that the signal for a fifth channel should have a different polarisation from existing TV signals, to help cut down problems with interference. Again, this means viewers would need a different type of aerial. Until now, paying for television in the United Kingdom has been relatively straightforward. Apart from the low penetration of cable television, viewers have paid their licence fees to watch BBC, while advertising has paid for the ITV channels. In future, it will be more complicated with the advent of subscription television or pay-to-view on commercial channels, to an extent on the BBC and on satellite channels. Viewers will need extra electronic equipment attached to sets that ensures they see only what they have paid for. There are different definitions of subscription or pay-to-view. Essentially, the signals are scrambled before transmission and then decoded in special equipment at the television set so that only those viewers who have paid can see and hear the unscrambled version. The ways of doing this, which depend on the service providers, could range from a card, along the lines of a phone card, which would contain units of credit, to highly sophisticated systems where special software keys could be transmitted along with a coded signal to special chips in the reception equipment, allowing the set to receive the signal. In future, the UK will have a new transmission standard, known as DMAC, which will allow for different ways of controlling access to programmes, as well as providing stereo sound and high-definition TV. Today's PAL standard does allow a much simpler level of encryption. The BBC, for example, has already been experimenting with the idea by sending out information programmes in scrambled form to doctors in the early hours of the morning. Doctors equipped with special decoders and video recorders can play the unscrambled programme later in the day. For the viewer, it is important, albeit unlikely, that the broadcasters decide on a common way of encoding and decoding TV signals. Otherwise, those watching different subscription channels may need many different electronic black boxes. If some of the services are from satellite, the situation gets more confusing. A satellite reception dish bought to receive TV from one satellite may not be able to receive programmes beamed from another, because they need to be pointed very accurately at the transmitting satellite. The advent of microwave television adds to the electronic confusion. Whether they are offered on a local or regional basis, the microwave services might again require viewers to have a separate aerial in order to receive the signals. Much depends on the frequencies chosen for the services. If relatively low microwave frequencies for which the technology exists are chosen, the services could be introduced quickly. This would be good for viewers and for cable television companies, which could use microwaves to transmit the signals over the last leg of the journey to the home. It could, however, be bad for British industry. The technology comes mainly from overseas. If UK microwave television is introduced at higher frequencies, the viewer might have to wait, but at least British electronics companies might have time to catch up. That was from Mary Fagan, who's the technology correspondent of the Independent newspaper.
Shay to launch first all-system CT2 handset in Electronics Weekly. Shay Communications will be the first manufacturer to offer a digital cordless telephone, CT2, that, it claims, can be used on a majority of the UK's prospective telepoint networks. The company has launched its Forum personal phone, which will cost under £175. Shay, which has applied for a telepoint licence in partnership with Motorola, intends to market its CT2 to other potential operators. Bill Jeffrey, managing director of Shay, said that the company had received requests for quotations from most of the 11 licence applicants. With the issuing of licences expected before the end of the year, it is likely that only handsets from Shay and Ferranti will be available for the initial systems. These are planned to be set up early in 1989 and will not incorporate the Common Air Interface, CAI. Jeffrey believes that it will be 2 years before the availability of equipment that conforms to the CAI. Details of the CAI, drawn up by Shay and six other CT2 manufacturers, have recently been presented to the Department of Trade and Industry. The low-cost Forum will not include a paging facility, so the owner cannot be contacted. Jeff claims that it will have a 50-hour battery life before recharge.
A report from Michael Leitman of The Independent, entitled A Cool Reaction. The papers were largely enthusiastic about the broadcasting white paper. Some thought it went too far in loosening the public service regulations applying to television. Others believed it didn't go far enough. Papers whose proprietors have a stake in television tended towards the latter view. The Financial Times, 13.5% of British satellite broadcasting, wrote, "The broadcasting debate has been befuddled by the belief that the object is to produce good broadcasting as defined by broadcasters. One might as well say that the object of publishing was to produce books that appeal to booksellers or authors. The FT sees too many elements of continued censorship in the White Paper's proposals. Papers in the Rupert Murdoch stable, four channels of Sky Television on Astra Satellite next year, largely agreed. Today, thought that the impending multiplicity of channels already made the proposals out of date. No better than a quarter of a step in the right direction," they said. It complained that the policy still left the BBC and ITV companies too many privileges. The Sun editorial began, "Believe it or not, there are people who imagine we have the best television service in the world. As it happens, many of them are inside the BBC." Accusing the BBC of supporting evil terrorists, the Sun newspaper said, "Roll on the government's plans to provide competition and freedom in television." The Times was less sure what to think. It praised Mr. Hurd for not trying to have his cake and eat it by deregulating with one hand and piling up cumbersome public service obligations with the other. But it concluded, "The results, though certainly preferable to vain attempts to preserve the status quo, will not be easy to predict." The Daily Mail, part of a consortium that will provide daytime programming to BSB, welcomed the easing of public service restrictions. You pick what you want and you pay for it. Old-fashioned freedom. Robert Maxwell, at least two channels expected on Astra, took an opposite line from the other television barons. His Daily Mirror warned against letting deregulation go too far. "The new freedom must not degenerate into a choice between one awful imported soap or old film and another." Papers without television interests reinforced that warning. The Daily Telegraph had a bon mot to offer its readers. When ministers and civil servants enthuse about glittering new opportunities, it's often a sign that they're not excited at all, but are defending a course into which they have been forced by circumstances or by dogma. The paper was unsure whether or not the plans would produce commercial television no worse than we have now. It concluded, "This government has done great good by exposing large portions of British life to competition, but there are areas over which reservations must remain, and broadcasting is one of them." The Guardian feels more strongly. It said, "The great risk of the government's plan is that it will be delivering this major system into the hands of single-minded, narrow-minded money men. In the era of light-touch regulation, cultural questions slide effortlessly off the agenda." That was by Michael Leitman of The Independent.
Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar, and I don't see you anymore. I would not leave you in times of trouble. We never could have come this far. Mm-hmm. I took the good times, I'll take the bad times, I'll take you just the way you are. Don't go trying some new fashion. Don't change the color of your hair. Mm-hmm. You always have my unspoken passion, although I might not seem to care. I don't want clever conversation. Never want to work that hard. Mm-hmm. I just want someone that I can talk to. I want you just the way you are. Need to know that you will always be the same old someone that I knew. Promise from the heart. Mm-hmm. I couldn't love you any better. I love you just the way you are. Wait. I just want someone that I can talk to. I want you just the way you are.
get used to listening to AM signals through a synchronous detector, you will find it quite painful if you have to go back to an envelope detector. The improvement in signal-to-noise ratio and reduction in chatter from adjacent stations is particularly helpful on weak or fading signals. We produce a complete boxed phase lock synchronous detector, which accepts 455 kHz IF input to suit many receivers. The two audio line level outputs can be fed into a hi-fi stereo system, and the four front panel controls allow reception of double sideband, upper sideband, lower sideband, stereo spread or independent sideband with lower sideband on the left and upper sideband on the right, quadrature, which nulls the modulation of the strongest station on the channel and improves the audibility of weaker co-channel signals, and finally, a low distortion envelope detector. Apart from all this, there is also an audio level controller, which counteracts the objectionable surging in loudness as the carrier goes through a selective fade and the automatic gain control in the receiver unnecessarily increases the gain. The unit costs £150, and a detailed four-page information sheet is available if you send along one 14 pence British stamp or one international reply coupon to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG.
A letter from Patrick Whitten, the Managing Director of Communications and Information Technology Research, as appeared in The Independent. Dear Sir, the broadcasting white paper makes imaginative, some may say fanciful, reading. Yet, like the recent debate, it is short on facts and figures. Boring as these may be, they're indispensable for policy making in a high cost and complex area. Readers might like some comparative data. Cable television is growing by 10% a year in Western Europe. 14 million homes are now connected. Yet the UK figures 6 years since the Hunt Commission Committee is only 275,000, 1% of households. So far, not much to get excited about there. And while Europe already has more than 35 satellite television channels, 23 of them commercial, none is yet profitable, even those of 6 years vintage. Yet 12 new English language satellite channels are scheduled in the next year or so. It takes a leap of faith to see them doing much better. As for the much vaunted subscription television, apart from modest progress in that land of broadcasting excellence, the United States, where it depends on 44 million cable homes, half the country, the only European success is France's Channel Plus. The low-cost national coverage via the old VHF network, plus a relaxed attitude to blue films, ensures a 12% take-up and profitability. For true competitive broadcasting, two points are of concern. If by the mid-1990s the 12 new satellite channels together reach a million homes, and, where available, gain 10% of the audience, both optimistic figures, each would have an average share of less than 0.04% of total UK viewing. This will not sustain even the most tolerant advertiser, or cover the cost of subscriber transmissions. With even more channels, the arithmetic is correspondingly worse, for most new services will compete for the same peak time mass audience. Second, given the problem of cable, satellite and subscription television, it's paradoxically the BBC that has relatively most to gain. While it can now earn extra from paid television, which with its size, audience and programming facilities is relatively well equipped to do, at the same time its current and future competition is weakened or impossibly fragmented. So once again, the government's commercial sense seems no better than its powers of intellect or analysis. The likely outcome of all the huffing and puffing is the exact opposite of what was apparently intended. Yours sincerely, Patrick Whitten, Managing Director of the Communications and Information Technology Research, a letter which appeared in The Independent.
The BBC has a new Band 1 radio microphone design. Design and Engineering Department's new Band 1 system operates in the two post-Merryman sub-bands allocated for radio microphone use, 53.75 to 55.75 MHz and 60.75 to 62.75 MHz. By using low deviation FM for spectral efficiency, 19 100 kHz spaced channels can be accommodated in either subband with no compromise on audio quality. However, having the channels so closely spaced can lead to intermodulation problems between nearby transmitters. The new equipment addresses this problem by using circulators in the aerial feed.
A letter from Brian Waters in the Times recently, entitled Rationing of Radio Stations. Dear Sir, your leading article on the need for change in British broadcasting focuses on television, and I do not disagree with its sentiment there, but the same does not apply to radio. There is no evidence to indicate popular discontent, you say. 22 years ago, this land was ringed by 10 offshore radio stations, which revived radio audiences and boosted the British music industry until they were viciously outlawed. Recently, two radio ships, Laser and Caroline, commanded such an audience in England that official audience research was suspended. Last year, Radio Caroline 558 could still claim the largest commercial radio audience in the United Kingdom. At the same time, a host of pirates has invaded the otherwise largely silent FM band across the country. One of these was even voted by the Evening Standard readers the most popular in London last year. No indication of popular discontent? I believe there's a compelling case for a real deregulation of radio. Restrictive practices must be quashed. The wave bands can accommodate around 60 stations serving any area, and should be allocated to broadcasters who offer consistent formats, especially for music radio. Public service and good speech radio may well have to accept its role as a minority interest, but let's have an end to the tiresome and obsolete dog's dinner formats to which the authorities have rationed us for far too long. And that was from Brian Waters.
In the legal advice section in the Financial Times, a question: TV or not TV? During the week, I live in a small leasehold flat, which has a communal central television aerial. At weekends, I live at my main residence, where I have a fully licensed television set and a VCR. I am now contemplating buying a television set and a VCR and installing them at my flat without an aerial connection, to play pre-recorded tapes only. I do not intend to receive television transmissions. Do I need to buy a television receiving license to cover playing either commercially bought or hired videotapes only, or tapes pre-recorded on my licensed equipment at my home or on friends' equipment? And the reply from the Financial Times legal people is as follows. You do not need a license for either category, but you might have difficulty in proving that your use of the television set is in fact really limited to use with a VCR.
Radio pirates stake claim to Thatcher's Britain, a report by Heather Mills of The Independent. Bad Boy West surveys the peeling wallpaper and frayed carpet and grins. This pokey top floor room dominated by a double bed is his dream come true, the unlikely home of Sunrise FM, one of the newest pirate radio stations. In the corner of his third floor room of a nondescript house in the East End of London is a turntable and an assembly of simple electrical equipment that is the Sunrise recording studio. It churns out street music on 88.75 FM, which to the unsophisticated ear sounds pretty much the same, but to the connoisseur is divided into acid house, garage, hip-hop, ravers and rap. Largely hard beat music that originated in the United States inner cities. The rooftop transmitter is distinguishable from a television aerial only to the expert eye. It's a cheap operation. A pirate station can get on air for as little as £200, and the Department of Trade and Industry estimates there are about 90 of them in Britain. but the studio is a long way from the Citizens Band radio over which Bad Boy used to broadcast. As he chats about soul over the end of a rarer soul record, the 22-year-old DJ, a security officer in the outside world, doesn't look like a bad boy at all. He and his fellow disc jockeys such as Chris Acid Gangster Marx, Maniacs Paul, Tony Crucial White and Judge Jimmy claim to be part of Thatcherite Britain. "We've created our own business and employment. That's what she wants, isn't it?" Maniac said. Now Sunrise 23 DJs want to apply for one of the 20 franchises that Douglas Hurd, the Home Secretary, has promised for community radios. With a mixture of black and white, men and women, and an age range of 17, DJ Kelly, who is half of Double Trouble, to 50, Judge Jimmy, who is into revival reggae, Sunrise claims to be a fair representation of the community to which it caters. It makes no excuses for illegality. "We're giving the people what they want. We're playing the sort of music that does not get played on the commercial channels. What's wrong with that?" they ask. "We've tested our broadcasts and our nearest neighbour is Radio 2 and we don't interfere with the quality of that at all." Known as Acid House Station, the DJs are concerned at the recent publicity that has surrounded police raids on Acid House parties, named after the music, not the drugs. Maniac says, "Take most large parties and there are almost certainly to be a few who'll be taking drugs. But it's nonsense to slag off the music because of this. We would never encourage our listeners to take any form of drugs." Although some well-established pirate stations are known to make quite a lot of money from advertising and record promotions, Sunrise, which has only been on the air since April, is being subsidised by Judge Jimmy and its DJs. Most have worked outside of the station. But now we're going. Nothing is going to stop us," Bad Boy says. "Of course we want to get a licence, but our main aim is to make people happy, and that's what we do. Now we've started, we can't let people down." That places Sunrise in a dilemma. Mr. Hurd has specified that from 1st of January, anyone convicted of illegal broadcasting will be disqualified for 5 years for applying for a franchise.
See you.
Radio Facts will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December, unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the, presumably inevitable, court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank you again to everyone who's taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such an age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried are development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the invention of magnetic recording from wire recorders to digital tape, and others, have brought in letters from people involved in the work for up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would like to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we have achieved might be the most listened to programme per watt transmitted. And we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Facts.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that with a view to the future, what Radio Facts has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think Radio Facts or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A OAA.
And the ministers responsible are Douglas Hurd and Timothy Renton at the Home Office, Queen Anne's Gate, London SW1H 9AT. You are the people who know it is rubbish to say that no frequencies are available. There are a greater number of you using the HF spectrum for education and recreation than all other users put together. So your voice should carry some weight in decisions about what some small fraction of it is used for.
A report by Maggie Brown, the media correspondent of The Independent, entitled "New TV Channel Will Not Cover South Coast." Channel 5, as proposed in the broadcasting white paper, would exclude a 25-mile deep swathe over southern England running from Dover to Cornwall, one of the wealthiest parts of the country and highly attractive to national advertisers, the Independent Broadcasting Authority have said. This was a finding of a hurried 3-month study carried out for the government last year, which provided the basis for the Home Secretary's announcement of Channel 5's launch, covering 65% to 70% of the country in 1993. It's designed to provide competition to a reformed Channel 3 ITV system, yet it would not include much of the franchise area of TVS, based in Southampton, the most costly region for television advertising. The study found a way of freeing two bandwidths, allowing a semi-national service to start, but said there were severe problems involved in serving coastal regions, especially the South Coast, although London would probably be covered. This was because transmissions would cause interference with domestic services in neighbouring countries like France, Belgium, Holland and Ireland. It's not a simple matter. People will also have to buy another aerial a member of the committee said. The prospects of shoehorning in a subsequent Channel 6 are also viewed with great scepticism. The Independent Broadcasting Authority, whose engineers have carried out a great deal of work on MVDS, local microwave television, which the Home Office said could provide perhaps 30 local television stations in the 1990s, said that it would only have one limited use in Britain. This was because the signals to receivers required a clear line of sight and worked best if transmitters were placed on hills. Microwave television would be technically feasible in Bath, for example, but difficult in Bristol. That was a report from Maggie Brown, the media editor of the Independent newspaper.
We at Radio Facts sent out a press release recently, and if you haven't heard the text of what it said, here is part of it. In response to the application for a radio broadcasting licence made to the Independent Broadcasting Authority in October of this year, Lord Thompson of Monifieth, chairman of the IBA, responded personally as follows. He regrets the IBA is unable to help with a licence under present legislation. The IBA can only transmit local sound broadcasting, whereas Radio Fax's intention is to cover the British Isles. He urges Radio Fax to press the Home Office to address the HF aspect, as it has not featured in any discussions the IBA have had with Home Office officials. And finally, Lord Thompson wishes Radio Fax luck with its exciting project.
More Trevor.
There's a little on.
Paris and Bonn to set up joint TV network by David Marsh in Bonn, writing for the Financial Times. The French and West German governments have agreed to set up in 1990 a joint television network to distribute cultural programmes in several languages through European satellite and cable transmission. The project will be operated from Strasbourg and cost an initial ECU £120 million, that's £79 million sterling, annually. It was announced in Bonn after the latest 6 monthly consultations between the two governments. Bonn, Paris and companies from the two countries will also collaborate on developing a joint standard for new generation high-definition television as a means of boosting European expertise in this area against Japanese competition. The new network will initially use one channel on the French DirecTV satellite TDF1 based on the European D2MAC transmission standard. That's a report in the Financial Times.
RDAT at the BBC. From International Broadcasting. Realising the potential of DAT, digital audio tape, the United Kingdom broadcaster was quick to purchase and use machines when they became available. Sean Meehan, project engineer at BBC Radio Capital Projects, describes the reasons for purchase and the uses to which each of the Sony machines have been put. The introduction and development of RDAT is seen by the BBC as an important step that could have a significant effect on the future of radio. Up until mid-1987, there had been much speculation as to what this new breed of technologically advanced recorders could do, and indeed what they should be allowed to do. Copyright protection, for example. Remember the CopyCode saga. The lure to the broadcaster of the advantage offered by these machines was too great to resist. A 16-bit system offering CD-like quality could now be recorded on even the humblest RDAT recorder. There was to be no wow and flutter, very low distortions, extended frequency response, and good signal-to-noise ratio. There were other advantages. We already knew that there was a certain amount of robustness offered by the digital signal when accompanied by good error detection and correction, the ability to do tape dubbing without losing the quality of the original signal, the potential power and flexibility provided by the amount and variation of data capable of being stored within the labyrinths of the subcode and PCM data areas. This could open up new possibilities in tape labelling and editing, and up to 2 hours of continuous stereo programme, without having to change spools, all on a tape the size of a compact cassette. It almost seemed too good to be true. We conducted some preliminary tests in April 1987 to evaluate the technical performance of an RDAT recorder, a Sony DTC 1000 ES, which was the only machine we could get our hands on at the time. Despite the fact that this was classed as a domestic machine, its performance proved to be very respectable indeed. Our appetite was whetted and we soon hoped to have a few machines which we could try out on real programmes. A decision was taken in September 1987 to buy six RDAT machines to gain familiarisation with this new technology. Because of the problems in conducting the launch of RDAT, the first machines did not cross the portals of the BBC until December 1987. It was not surprising that these first machines were the domestic Sony DTC 1000ES. The machines were grabbed by eager hands and were whisked off to various corners of BBC radio. One was used to carry out further technical tests, and the others were immediately put into operational service. As soon as word was passed around that some machines had arrived, we met our first problem. Everyone wanted to use them. The immediate reaction to the new machine was very encouraging, and everyone was impressed by the sound quality, particularly in the clarity of imaging and improved transient response, which was noticeably better than on most good analogue machines. Bells, for example, which are not very peaky in response, often sound muddy on analogue tape, but on digital tape they become very realistic. Radiophonic workshops were among the first to use these machines for programme use, and the result was a programme about Martin Luther King, called The Dream, with music by Richard Attree. It was broadcast on Easter Sunday, the 1st of April 1988, on BBC Radio 1. The main problem with the DTC 1000 is the fact that it has domestic tape interfacing with phono connectors for the inputs and outputs. This meant that it had to be connected to our systems by means of ProPacks, a domestic to professional audio interface, to provide balanced XLR inputs and outputs. The digital in and out was, for the greater part, left unused, because it was not easy to connect it to our AES EBU interfaces, that being the standard which we have adopted wherever we need to use digits for broadcast use. During the course of our technical testing, we discovered that it is very important to keep the heads and tape scrupulously clean. During tests on error performance, a small piece of debris on the tape caused a burst of about 700 errors to be detected. The debris was removed, and the tape subsequently overwritten without further problem. The trials, however, on the DTC 1000 domestic machine were very encouraging, and everyone now waited in anticipation for the arrival of the professional studio machine, the Sony PCM 2500. It was hoped that this machine would offer solutions to our interfacing problems. In March 1988, we received eight PCM 2500s, some of which went to Radiophonics, some to Radio Outside Broadcasts, and some to Broadcasting House Studios and recording channels. These machines were basically the DTC 1000 with an additional interface box, which could give us all the right connections for professional use. Now that we could digitally connect to our system, a major shortcoming of the 2500 came to light: synchronisation. These machines are fine where they have to operate asynchronously, for example in tape-to-tape copying, or if you are using the analog output. But in order to broadcast digitally, it is necessary to have an AES EBU word sync input, which the PCM 2500 does not have. However, the machine was used to produce digitally recorded programs, which were then transmitted via the analog outputs. Two such programmes recorded on DAT were Cry, recorded at the Queen Elizabeth Hall and broadcast on Radio 3 on 10th of May 1988, and A Scarecrow Singing, broadcast on Radio 4 on the 3rd of August. During this period, we were exploring the best way to edit and label tapes. The Start ID, Skip ID and programme numbering systems were useful for labelling chunks of tape, but were not ideal for achieving fine editing or cueing. The auto ID function proved to be not entirely reliable. Sometimes an index was placed at the start of a track, and on other occasions it would be up to 2 seconds into the track. This may be due to the fact that the indexing system relies on modulation detection. Sony say its threshold is set about 42 dB below peak. This error can be corrected by manually placing the ID where required. Other minor quibbles were that if there was a pause in a programme for over 3 seconds, the machine would think it was a new track and record a new ID. Tracks could only consistently be found if the machine had first searched through track one. Despite the minor problems with the PCM2500, we decided to buy a further eight with a specific project in mind, the Radio 1 Golden Oldies. Dave Price, head of planning and presentation at Radio 1, explains the background. Radio 1's heritage of classic oldies, great hit records of the past, which form a substantial part of our daily output, have been wearing out at an alarming rate, and many are simply not playable over our new FM network. 2 years ago, I initiated a programme to dub 5,000 good quality singles, mostly from private libraries, onto quarter-inch tape with the intention of putting each title onto NAB cartridge. This caused operational problems for the DJs, so I decided to change to DAT when the 2500 became available. A DAT collection of 5,000 titles on 500 tapes would occupy about 1/12 the volume of a NAB cartridge collection, reducing the storage problem by an order of magnitude, 6 square feet as opposed to 70 square feet. A long NAB cartridge can take about 3 minutes to be re-queued, whilst an RDAT can be re-queued in less than 30 seconds, worst case. With a little luck, we could also take advantage of the DAT's tape's capacity to store the ISRC, International Standard Recording Code, and catalogue numbers, and hook it up to our computer for logging play times. The latter proved to be very difficult to implement, since we could not easily access the appropriate codes. This was a great pity, as we had hoped to exploit the soft areas where the user-defined non-audio data is carried. The PCM blocks give an overall data rate of 16.001 kilobits per second, and the subcode blocks give 194.15 or 224.02 if the user chooses not to have parity, kilobits per second, but only if both areas are given over entirely to the soft mode. By December, we hope to have two DAT players in each studio and 500 DAT cassettes, each containing 10 easily accessible titles. All our oldies will sound as good as new on our new FM stereo service. To date, about 1,000 DAT 60-minute tapes have been recorded for this project, with not one tape failure. Long-term storage on DAT has not been fully documented, but first indications show that it is a reasonable storage medium. In any case, we will back our horses both ways by keeping our original source material on existing formats, mainly quarter-inch tape, but some on vinyl disc, CD, and PCM F1 or 701 format. One area of particular interest to the broadcaster is the origination of source material, and to this end a vast amount of material is collected on location, so it was good news for us when the portable RDAT machines were announced. The first portable RDAT machine to make its way into the BBC was the TCD D10 in April 1988. We ordered six and were soon to discover how wonderful these little members of the DAT family were. Soon, these relatively cheap machines were being taken out in place of Nagras and were being whisked off to various parts of the world. In August, recordings were made for Radio 3 at the Bayreuth Festival using the D10. This consisted of interviews and actuality for which this machine is ideally suited. Talks and Documentaries Science Unit have used the D10s for similar tasks and again are delighted with the results. The index functions are very popular, saving time when it comes to editing later. The sound effects field worker, who collects items for the BBC sound effects CDs, among other tasks, used the D10 in many situations and found it to be a very impressive piece of kit. The D10 has been to airfields and on aircraft, including the flight deck of Concorde, and was not in the least affected by radar blips, as some other machines seem to be. The compact size and low weight of the D10 make it an ideal choice for use in confined spaces, such as the flight deck mentioned earlier, and also makes it more acceptable to the sound recordist to take on longer trips. This is happening to such an extent that even professional walkmans are being left behind in preference to the D10.